Just very quickly, a review of last week. We talked about in introducing the book, and we'll spend one more day in introducing the book, and then next Sunday we'll get into the text. But we talked about the author, who of course was John the Apostle. It's made clear that it's John. This John didn't need any kind of descriptive statement. It's obvious who it was that wrote the book. And we talked about when it was written and the importance, the particular importance of the date of the writing of the book of Revelation, because it helps us in understanding the book. And I believe, and I've presented to you the evidence that convinces me, that it was written at the latter part of the first century, somewhere 96 A.D. or maybe perhaps a little bit later, long about that period of time, at the end of the first century. Written by John, the apostle, who was exiled on the island of Patmos, a little island in the Aegean Sea, about 50 or 60 miles southwest of Ephesus. It was a rock quarry. And I forget, but it seemed like to me the dimensions were something like 6 miles wide and 8 or 10, 12 miles long, a small island, probably few inhabitants at that time. And so John was exiled there, as we think, probably by Domitian, the emperor. Domitian, who became emperor in 81 A.D., and was then succeeded by Nerva, who became emperor after Domitian. And Domitian probably exiled John sometime maybe in 95 or so A.D. And then Nerva released him some 18 months later, according to tradition. And he was allowed to return to his brethren in Ephesus. That's a little bit about the introduction to the book. And we'll talk a little bit more about it this morning. The book of Revelation, then, when we think about it, is a message for the first century as well as a message for us. If you have studied the book of Revelation and to any degree at all, then you know that over the years, many, many, many books, commentaries have been written concerning the book of Revelation. And most of the people who write commentaries or various kinds of writings about the book of Revelation are categorized by one of several different lines of reasoning. And I want to mention a few of those just briefly to kind of give you some background to help you to understand why and how it is that different people approach the study in different ways. One category is referred to as futurist. These are people who see chapters 4 through 19 as occurring primarily in the future from when John lived, but in a time just prior to Jesus' second coming to earth. These people, for the most part, interpret the book literally, or much of it literally, including, of course, the thousand-year reign that is mentioned in chapter 20, verses 1 to 10, the premillennial theories that have grown up around that. And Andrew talked last Sunday night, for those of you who were here, about that and gave a great lesson on that. Various theories of premillennialism based on this one mention in Revelation, in my view, misunderstood. They go to several other places in the New Testament and take those passages out of context to support it. But anyway, the futurists, or those who hold this view, they see the thousand-year reign of Christ. By that, they mean that they expect Christ to come back to earth, establish a kingdom in Jerusalem, and reign for 1,000 years on earth. That will be followed by the judgment, which is mentioned in the latter part of the 20th chapter. And then you have heaven or hell, as the case may be, following the judgment. So that's the futurist. Secondly, there's a group referred to as continuous historical group. These are those who believe that the book describes all of history of mankind until the end of time. And this is held almost exclusively by Protestants. And most of them see in Revelation 13 the Pope and the Roman Catholic Church as the beast that is mentioned there. By the way, I was just given this morning, Brother Wagner gave me a moment ago to read a thesis that he wrote on Revelation 13, and I look forward to reading that this week. But they hold this view that the Roman Church and the Pope is the beast mentioned there. They hold different views concerning, they have different understandings regarding what particular signs or symbols in the book mean and what events in history they refer to. A lot of differences of opinion in that, but they do believe that they point to history, the entire history of mankind. This view has led some to predict the year, and in some cases, the exact day of the end of the world, which of course proved to be embarrassing to those who made such predictions. Another group are referred to as the preterist, from the Latin word preter, which means past. And these people hold that the book was written solely for the people of John's day. And so they read the book of Revelation merely as history, thinking that it has all passed. There's even one brother in our fellowship who holds that view and used to write and speak about it rather prevalently. And it's all been fulfilled, and the Catholic scholars tend to fall into this category, because obviously if this view is correct, then they're off the hook. They couldn't possibly be the ones that are referred to, the Roman Catholic Church couldn't possibly be the one referred to as the beast in chapter 13 if it all happened at the time of John the Baptist. I might add too that some are only partial preterists. And that's true of all of these different views. People, there are different shades of those who fall within those categories. Then there's the philosophy of history group. These are those who hold the view, and it's also sometimes referred to as a symbolic view. They hold that the symbols in the book of Revelation describe forces that are constantly at work in the world. In other words, different things that we read about in the book of Revelation, different visions, symbols, and such like, they say refer to different events at different periods of time. The events that are somewhat similar, but all through history, refer to events occurring all through history. It's of course true that the forces of good and evil are always in conflict, but that's not exactly what they mean. They refer to it in a more specific sense. Finally, there is a group referred to as the historical background group. These include those who understand the dire circumstances that existed in the first century church. They acknowledge that Revelation was written primarily to encourage the saints who lived at that period of time, who were suffering or who soon would be suffering great persecutions. But they also believe that the book has a meaning for our day as well. Now, I mention these only to help us to understand the emphasis that different writers bring to the interpretation of the book. I don't subscribe to the view of one writer I read who said this. He said, "Before you begin to study the book of Revelation, you must decide which approach you will use. Decide which one makes more sense to you than the others. As if one was as good as another. You might choose this one or that one. It doesn't really make that much difference. But I don't subscribe to that view of fact. In fact, I don't subscribe in the ultimate sense to any of these views. I believe that one should approach the study of Scripture with an open mind, without any preconceived ideas, and make an honest, earnest effort to understand what the writer is saying. That's why Brother W.B. West used to talk about the need of our studying the book of Revelation through what he referred to as first century glasses. Brother West was invited to speak over in England on one occasion at one of the universities there, and after doing so for some period of time, the students presented to him a pair of the old-fashioned glasses that he thought a lot of, and because he had made reference so frequently in his talks about Revelation to studying through what he referred to as first century glasses. It is often the case that one approaches a study of Scriptures, a teacher or a preacher or a writer, and he will go to a passage to prove what he or she already believes, not to learn what the passage is actually saying. And when one does this, one is really, in essence, moving John out of the book of Revelation and moving himself in. Or a better way to say it would be to say that when one does this, he's moving Christ out of the book of Revelation and moving himself in. The technical expression for this, or the technical word for this, is eisegesis, as opposed to exegesis. You, of course, are familiar with the Greek word exegesis, which means to lead out, to draw out of, and it has reference to the interpreter who seeks to discover the meaning that the writer has in the words that he uses. So he goes to the Scriptures to learn what the passage is saying, not to prove what he already believes or thinks about it. And so, in our study of Revelation, we want to know what John is talking about, what Jesus revealed to John by his angel through these various visions and so forth. And so, I mentioned a while ago that all these commentaries have been written in recent years, a flood of them, and many of them have come from the premillennial point of view. They almost completely ignore the history of the times, and so we want to take note of this as we make our study. C.M. Dodd was a renowned New Testament scholar in Cambridge University, and he made a statement that I think is very important. He said, "The first responsibility of the student of God's word, the teacher, the preacher, or the writer, whoever, the first responsibility is to sit with the author of the passage under consideration to learn what he had in mind." I like the way he says that. And you can kind of, as if when we read and study this, not just Revelation, but any Scripture, we should approach it as though we have the opportunity to sit down with the one who actually wrote it and discuss it with him. What are you saying? What are you talking about? What did you have in mind? That's what we need to do when we study the Scriptures. Sit with the author. Try to determine what he had in mind. And then we should go and sit with those to whom it is written, to see how they understood it. To see how they understood it. And of course, when we understand what it meant to them, then we can understand what principles are involved that may relate to us as well. This is really what Brother West had in mind. when he talked about reading Revelation through first century glasses. So I want us to take just a few minutes and see if we can illustrate or see if we can delve in a little bit to this concept of reading the book of Revelation through first century glasses. I want us to think about the rule of the Roman Empire at this time in history, at the close of the first century, especially in the region of Asia Minor. And I want us to think about the Christians who lived under this Roman rule at the time. This is where, in Asia Minor, this is where the seven churches are found to whom the epistle was first addressed and who read it perhaps first. These were Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. Now, the Roman Empire was the largest, the richest, and the most powerful empire the world had ever known. Romans boasted that the Roman eagles, these were the standards that were carried by the Roman armies as they marched. They boasted that the Roman eagles never turned backward. They boasted that the Roman Empire would be eternal and that all roads lead to Rome. The Roman Empire was built by war. It was built by conquest and the forceful takeover of territories. And then it was strengthened by international trade and commerce. Shipping brought products to Rome from all over the world, from Egypt, from Spain, from Arabia, from the Orient. And the Romans had in many ways a remarkable society. They built the first interstate road systems. Actually, they were international road systems, roads that went not only from city to city, but from nation to nation and through nations on to other nations. I had the opportunity in mid-60s of walking on the Appian Way, the road, no doubt, that the Apostle Paul traveled as he was taken into Rome. And just recently, I saw a cutout. That's not the word I'm looking for, but these roads that they made were remarkable, and there are examples of them still existing in various parts of the world. And I saw this, again, it's not coming to him, but this cutout of how these roads were made is incredible. The various layers, and it's easy to understand how they would still exist even until today because they were made in such a substantial way. These roads had mile markers. They had road signs and all this. Of course, they were built with slave labor. And of course, the Romans had millions upon millions of slaves available to them, and they used them in the making of these. We mentioned earlier that Rome was wealthy. Now, the upper class was very wealthy. It was not uncommon for a citizen in Rome to own hundreds of slaves, each with a specific task. I have read that some of the women were so wealthy that they had a slave for each shade or type of makeup that they used for their eyes, for their lips, or whatever. They wore expensive jewelry. They were extremely wealthy. So the rich were very rich, but the poor were very poor. There was no middle class. In fact, there was little difference between a slave and a free working person who was free but just had to make his living the best he could. In fact, those who were free found few opportunities to earn a living. And because of this, many of them begged to become a slave in order that they might survive. Now, if you want to know something about the moral condition of the Roman world, just read the latter half of the book of Romans chapter 1. And their moral decline, as Paul describes in that passage, was blatant. It was bold. And Paul ended that discussion of those sins by saying that not only did the people do these things themselves, but they took pleasure in the fact that others did them as well. In other words, evil made no attempt to hide in the darkness. Does that remind you of anything? Marriage was a commercial transaction. It could be canceled at any time. When children became a burden to a family, they simply were sold into slavery. And infants were often exposed to the elements, left in the elements to die or to be killed by animals or what have you. Even their religious ceremonies were defiled, many of the women becoming prostitutes in their pagan festivals and the such like. By the time of Domitian, as we talked about last week, the emperor had declared himself to be God, Lord of the empire, and all were commanded to bow before him and acknowledge him and to drop a pinch of incense into the fire and say, "Caesar is Lord." And those who didn't were guilty of treason, and they were burned at the stakes, thrown to the lions, banished as John was, or had their property seized and taken away from them, dismissed from their jobs. All kinds of things happened in various places in the Roman Empire to those who refused to acknowledge the emperor as Lord and God. Christianity in the Roman Empire, especially in the time that we're studying about, was religio illicita. It was an illegal religion. It was illegal to be a Christian. It was also considered a runaway cult. It was spreading so quickly throughout the world as the adherents of Christianity went everywhere preaching the word, that it was growing faster than anyone could devise means to stop it. Christianity was thought to be an exclusive religion. Its adherents would not mingle with the customs and social life of the pagans. And they refused to enter pagan temples. They rejected pagan rituals and customs. And Christians were accused of all manner of evil. Because they were misunderstood, they were hated, they were laughed at, made fun of, and they were, they were accused of all kinds of things. They were accused of being cannibals, of cannibalism, because they, quote, ate flesh and drank blood. Of course, this was a reference to the Lord's Supper, which they misunderstood. They were accused of incest because of their loving one another and their kissing one another with a holy kiss and their fellowships, their love fest, and their referring to one another as brother and sister and the like. And not understood, they were accused of incest. Christianity grew most among the poor and the outcast. And so the Romans considered them to be not to be respectable people because they came largely from that class of people. They were accused of being fanatics because of their wild enthusiasm. Christians were thought to have offended the Roman and Greek gods, and because of this, they were blamed with all kinds of calamities: fire, drought, flood, famine, whatever, military losses. The Christians were blamed with them. And the Romans considered them to be atheists. Isn't that a turn of events? Because they did not believe in their gods, they were considered to be atheists. If you read Fox's Book of Martyrs and read about the death of Polycarp, who you remember from our study last week was a disciple of John when John was in Ephesus before he was exiled. Polycarp, late in life, in his 80s, the magistrate was, well, he had, took pity on him in a way and was trying to find a way to release him. And he said, look, all you got to do is just drop a pinch of incense in this and make this claim that Caesar's Lord. You don't have to die. Don't prove to these people that you're not an atheist. And Polycarp pointed to the Romans who were there assembled and said, you are the atheists. And then he made his famous statement about 80 and so many years I've served the Lord and I'll not desert him at this point. But they believed Christians to be atheists because they didn't believe in God. Now, what I'm saying, folks, is simply this. It was war. It was spiritual warfare between the church and the Roman Empire. It began as somewhat of a local thing when the Christians were persecuted by Nero in the city of Rome itself. Nero, you know, Rome had burned in AD 64, and a lot of the people blamed Nero for that. And so Nero used the Christians as a scapegoat to turn away these accusations that he had burned Rome. He lit his gardens with burning Christians and fed them to the lions and so forth. But that persecution was largely local, confined to in and around Rome itself. But in about 30 years later, when Domitian was emperor, another onslaught of persecutions began, and these spread throughout the Roman Empire because, as we've said on several occasions, Domitian demanded that the subjects, especially Christians, acknowledge him as king and so forth. And so they were required to worship him. So, in summary, the purpose behind John's writing the book was that Christ, the purpose for him writing down what Jesus revealed to him through these various visions, is revealed by the situation at hand. And that situation was that the people he addressed were living in the midst of a bloody persecution. Or, if they were not then being persecuted, they soon would face persecutions. And the same was true all over the Roman Empire. Faith in Jesus Christ was bringing Christians face to face with the executioner's sword. We'll see when we read the letters to the seven churches that one named Antipas, who was a member of the church at Pergamum, had already been put to death. So they were already experiencing these persecutions. And John, of course, himself was in exile. And one of the ways that he had, well, of course, the whole book is his way of encouraging and the disciples and strengthening them to hold up and to endure under these persecutions. One of the ways specifically, as we'll see when we get into chapter 7, is when John shows them what he was shown, reveals that the redeemed adorned in white robes with palms in their hands had come up out of this great tribulation on earth. They had, in other words, they had died for their faith, but that death had ushered them what? Into the immediate presence of God. And here they are crying with a loud voice in verses 9 and 10 of chapter 7. Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. And so all through the book, the writer is encouraging and helping them to and strengthening them against what they were facing. You remember, Jesus had said to his disciples that upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. But from a worldly point of view, the picture was dim at times, wasn't it? As Danny Dodd, in this article that I've mentioned to you, said in his article, the church at this time was engaged in a spiritual warfare. Now, this was in real time and space. This was a warfare. And the Christians were on the battlefield. And the dragon, who is Satan, was attacking them. And unfortunately, there were casualties in this battle. But John wants them to know that it was a struggle in which heaven was involved. God was engaged in this struggle. Reminds me of the song, "This world is not my home. I'm just a passing through. My treasure is laid up somewhere beyond the blue." That could be thought of as one of the songs that fits well with the message of the book of Revelation. Satan would not have the final say. Ultimately, he would be defeated and thrown into the fiery abyss forever. Revelation 20 and verse 10. And even amid their suffering, the promise of victory was real, and it was reassuring. In Revelation 2 and verse 7, as we'll note, the writer says, "To him that overcomes, to him I will give to eat of the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God." To him that overcomes. One of the things that we learn from the book of Revelation, as the song that I just referenced mentions, this world is not our home. We're just passing through, and we tend to put our roots down too deeply here, don't we? We tend to count too much on this world, but the world to come is that which awaits those who overcome and who are. Satan has already been defeated. He either doesn't know, well, he won't recognize it. He won't acknowledge it. And he'll continue, for as long as this world stands, he'll continue to pull down with him into hell as many as he possibly can. But he's already been defeated. He was defeated when Christ was raised from the dead, when he ascended back to the Father, and where he sits now at the right hand of God. And John, you might think of Revelation as John the writer, as a general of an army, on his horse. I kind of think of him on his horse, riding up and down the lines of his soldiers and encouraging them, keeping them steady in the lines. Stay true. Overcome. And heaven will be your home. And so the purpose of the book is revealed in this situation. These people undergoing persecution. And of course that has application for us, as we'll see all the way through it. But we're already experiencing some things in this life that I never thought we would experience it. Do you see what I'm saying? And Christianity is under attack. It's not yet to the scale and in the same way that it was there, but in a very real sense, it is under attack. And I want to make one other point, and then we'll continue with the text next week. The book of Revelation, you know, we talked last week about how that it is thought to be a difficult book. And there are things that are difficult to understand. And as I told you last week, and I want to keep repeating, there are some of the things that we may never fully understand. There are certain things that I don't fully understand, and I'll acknowledge it to you. I may share with you what some people say, you know, but in many cases, I don't know that I can agree with those. But we don't have to understand every single symbol, imagery, to understand the message. And the Lord wants us to know that he is revealing something. It's not a book that's a mystery. There's a message here that the first words of the book, the revelation of Jesus Christ. The word revelation is the Greek word apokalypsis. And you recognize the English version of that, apocalypse. But it the word means to uncover, to unveil, to make plain. And so Jesus is saying right at the beginning, this is a revealing. This is a making clear something that's very important. Some of these symbols, some think that a lot of these symbols are used to as a kind of a code to keep the Romans who were persecuting them from understanding that may be the case, but for whatever reason there are symbols and signs, but the meaning of this book as we go through it. Stick to the main track. We won't be running down every rabbit hole, as I said last week. And the meaning will be clear as we study it. Okie doke. Next week, we will get into the text itself. You remember what we said a moment ago? Try to sit down with the writer, as it were. And I want you to think about, as we head into the text, think about John on the island of Patmos. We don't know what his condition was. There are very likely not many people. In fact, I read that in the 50s, 1950s, a census was taken of that little island, and it was something like less than 2,000 people living on it then. It was basically a rock quarry. We don't know if there were other people there who had been banished. We don't know how many people were there, period, what they may have been there, but you can rest assured that like Paul, who used his imprisonment in Rome as an opportunity to teach, John used that occasion as an opportunity to teach. And so when we read that John was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, in other words, he was no doubt aware of what days of the week it was. When the Lord's day came around, he was ready for worship. And we'll talk about that a little bit. And whether it was by himself or whether he had some others, the converts that he had, I don't know. But he was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. And then when he had seen Jesus ascend back into heaven, you remember on the Mount of Olives, when they went out of the city and no doubt he thought as he saw him go up and then thinking about it as he walked away, he no doubt said to himself, I'll never see him again in this world. Think how surprised he was on the island of Patmos when the Lord appeared to him. Now, he doesn't look like he did the last time that John saw him. He was in the flesh the last time John saw him. But he looks like the Ancient of Days that you read about in Daniel chapter 7, who is God. The Ancient of Days is God. And it's not surprising that he in Revelation 1 would look like the Ancient of Days in Daniel 7, because he too is what? Is God. But we'll talk about all that next week. Thank you very much.